Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Rob, I've got a question for you to start off with today. I want to know if you, as a child, had a toy that I also had. I think it was really common, and I got it for Christmas one year, I remember. And what it was a plastic alien pistol that when you pulled the trigger, it would play one of a sequence of like five different sequences of sound effects. So the first one would go like, dew, 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 dew. And then the next one would go, woot, woot, woot. And the next one would be, like I've got that kind of memorized in my brain. And in the version that I had, there was like a little red and blue clear plastic case over some LED lights that would shoot back and forth when you fired the gun. Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know what the name of this thing is, so I don't know how to look it up.
I don't think I had the exact one you had, but I must have had like an earlier model because I had one that was black and red, and it did the exact same sound effects you're discussing here. So I feel like it had to have been the same tech in just a different color or like a slightly different plastic toy gun.
Now, there was one thing I liked about this toy gun, which was that it every time you pulled the trigger, it would make a different sound effect, which means that it was almost like you could imagine that you had like one of the stormtrooper blasters from the very beginning of Star Wars, where you have multiple settings. You can set, I guess, for the regular blast, and then you can set for stun, except the problem was you couldn't toggle the sound effects on this thing. They just went in a sequence. So if you wanted to get one sound effect in particular, you'd have to pull the trigger a certain number of times to like run through the cycle and get back there.
I think part of that is the toy designers focus on tormenting the parents, because I've noticed this in contemporary toys as well. My son has a few different lightsabers, and one of the ones he has, it seems to at random either do lightsaber noises or play part of the Star Wars theme, but it seems entirely unpredictable. So if the batteries are in, if the device is on, and it seems also confusing about if it's toggled on or not, like you're never sure. You as a parent listening in from the next room over, you don't know what to expect. It just keeps you completely on edge.
I think if you want to calibrate a sound effects toy for maximum parental torment, you should somewhat randomize the sounds that come out and the sequence at which they come out. Because that we know that randomized rewards, they tend to create more addictive effects. The child will make the sound effects more often for longer durations, and the parents will slowly lose their minds.
And of course, it's also in a way ridiculous, because when we were kids, but also kids today, perfectly capable of creating their own sound effects. Mm-hmm. You don't need the toy ray gun to go pew pew. You don't need the lightsaber to go because we can do those sound effects. We do them all the time. In fact, I think I read that they had to get onto Ewan McGregor in filming the prequel films because he kept making those sounds with his mouth during the lightsaber battles. Yeah, I read that somewhere. I don't know if that's true, but it's wonderful either way.
So he was like, Anakin, I have the high ground.
Yep, I think so.
But I guess this all comes up because today you wanted to talk about toy guns, which I thought was a very interesting topic.
Yeah, and in a way, this is a holiday episode because the holidays are about toys under the trees, right? And the holidays, at their best, are about imaginative escapes. And, you know, I know in my own experience raising an 8-year-old, it's proven impossible to ignore the specter of the gun. You know, it's everywhere. It was, you know, in our upbringing. So I thought it would be good to look at some of the sort of broad studies and meta-analyses that look at the idea of toy guns. Because, I mean, first and foremost, we have to recognize that actual guns are lethal instruments designed to kill animals and or humans, depending on their exact design. Now, gun ownership itself is obviously a divisive topic, and one can spend a lot of time discussing objections to the legal use of such weapons. And there's too much here for us to get into in this episode, but I think we can mostly agree that improper use and misuse of firearms is to be avoided. And in very broad strokes, I'm thinking about guns used in homicides and suicides, guns used in mass shootings, and accidental deaths involving firearms, especially those involving children.
Right. And of course, the obvious implication there is that children should not be playing with real guns, even though there's clearly a desire among many children to enact types of play that involve guns or involve surrogates for guns. So there's sort of a natural accommodation that happens there. It's like, well, kids want to pretend to play with guns. Obviously, they should not be seeking out and handling real guns. So give them plastic toy guns.
Yeah, and of course, you know, especially nowadays, but I mean, this was also present in the minds of parents in the past, too. You know, we ask ourselves, are we doing the right thing? Should they have toy guns? Should we take all the toy guns away?
Totally,
there's so many questions that emerge.
Yeah. I wonder about this question myself. I mean, I can very much see both sides of it. I mean, on one hand, I feel like, well, I mean, you know, conflict play is a normal type of imaginative play. One of the most common types of conflict that children are going to imagine, given the world we live in, is conflict with guns. So they will want to act that out. And in a way, that just seems like part of childhood development. But then on the other hand, like if you watch a child, like, you know, running around pretending to shoot each other, you're like, oh my God, no, something horrible is happening here. This can't be allowed.
Yeah. It gets increasingly complex the more you think about it, you know, because especially since you're dealing in different worlds, you know, generally speaking, like the child's world and their exposure to guns is almost entirely within this realm of fantasy, you know, if you're fortunate. And adults live in a broader world of understanding about what guns are and what they can do. And you don't want to just grab them and pull them completely into your bubble. But then also the question is, well, should I leave them over there in their bubble? Like, yeah, it becomes this labyrinth, this maze that you try and figure your way out of. So this is what we're going to basically be talking about in today's episode. But before we go further, I thought it might be helpful to go ahead and throw out some stats and some numbers just to, you know, underlie the conversation here. So according to the CDC, stats for 2018, the most recently made available as of this recording at the tail end of 2020, the United States saw 38,390 deaths from firearm violence in 2018. And that accounted for 74% of homicides and 51% of suicides. Those involved firearms. Additionally, Americans are 10 times more likely to be killed by guns than people in other developed countries, according to a 2016 study published in the American Journal of Medicine. Gun purchases surged over the summer in 2020, as did incidents of gun violence. And on top of that, of course, we faced increased awareness of police violence against minorities. And as Craig Jackson pointed out on The Conversation, despite lockdown measures in the U.S., mass shootings in the U.S. sharply rose. As of November 26th, I believe, there were 578 mass shootings in the country, already ahead of the total 417 from the year before.
So we have to face the fact that if our children are going to be running around pretending to play with guns, you're holding that in your head with the reality of all the terrible things that guns can do and have been used to do, even just in recent memory.
Yeah, I mean, as a parent, it is at once terrifying and then terrifyingly commonplace to get that robocall from your school telling you that the school has been locked down because of an incident in the surrounding area. But that everything is cool and it's shocking. And then you're like, oh, everything's okay. And then you ask yourself, should I feel okay about this? Because I feel like I shouldn't. But anyway, as far as children and guns go, some more stats here. A 2016 study published in the New England Journal of Medicine found that death by gunshot was the second highest cause of death in the United States in 2016 among children and adolescents ages 1 through 19. Firearms were the second leading cause of death in 2014 for American children between ages of 1 and 19, an average of 8 kids shot per day, if you average that out over the calendar year. And then 2020 also saw an uptick in unintentional shootings by children by 43% in March and April. And I believe commentators often link that to the fact that suddenly children were at home more, and it gave them greater opportunity to come across guns in the household and of course, that opens up the door for misuse and accidental usage of the weapon.
I think sometimes people get the feeling when you're talking about things like certain safety precautions involving gun storage, should you keep a gun stored in the home loaded and questions like that. It's strange how people can know what the risks of certain things are, but still think those risks only apply statistically to people in general, and I am not like people in general, so I'm okay. The same logic that holds true in general for people in households won't apply to me or to my household. I don't need to worry about that kind of stuff. Isn't it weird how we can think like that?
Yeah. And plus, I think we also color our estimation of these numbers based on our own experiences and the limited nature of our experiences. On one hand, I can look back at my own past and say, I grew up with guns in the household and I didn't, have an accident with a gun. I never loaded a gun on my own or anything like that. I don't think I knew anybody growing up that was engaged in a firearm-related accident or the accidental, discharge of a firearm in the house. But then again, that's just my limited experience,
Right.
And, and then rationally, I'm not willing to roll the dice for my own child based on what I experienced,
Right. I mean, but there is definitely a natural tendency to sort of think of yourself as an exception to whatever the statistical rule is, and to elevate the importance of anecdotes in your own life over the, what the risks actually are.
Exactly. Yeah. So as far as the stats go, we could keep going on and on about this and torturing the numbers. But and there are ultimately a number of different directions one could go into discussing these numbers, the causes, the possible solutions. But one question that always comes up, sometimes in good faith, sometimes as a distraction, is what about guns in childhood play? And one of the reasons, again, like we've been discussing, that this is so, something we end up meditating on so much is that, I found that guns in media and subsequently in play are almost impossible to avoid. Because while you can curate what your kids watch, and ultimately this is even harder than I expected it to be, they're still going to interact with other kids, and there's always going to be a kid on the playground that turns a stick into a weapon, turns a stick into a gun or a sword or a spear or what have you, but very often a gun. And even if they don't have access to sticks, they can make the finger guns and blast away, right?
Yeah, again, I think this comes down to this difficult question that people have over how much is it reasonable to try to control your child's experience of the world?
Yeah.
You're always going to be balancing that. I mean, when you talked about media, for some reason, the thing that immediately popped into my head is what happens once a child discovers YouTube? Do you just set a child loose on YouTube, or how do, if not, how do you prevent that from happening? I don't, you know, it just seems like it's mind boggling to me.
Yeah, it is. And we could certainly go on about that topic as well.
But of course, sorry, that's ancillary to your main point, which is about play. Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely clear, probably everybody who's been around kids for any amount of time or was once a child themselves probably remembers or has observed the natural emergence of violent and conflict play among kids. It doesn't seem like something... it's hard to rule this out, but it doesn't seem like something that like parents have to instruct their children how to do. It seems like it just kind of comes naturally out of the child brain that like we need to enact some kind of imaginative violent conflict.
Yeah. And then the gun being an inevitable part of the conflict media they absorb, it just becomes a part of it. And you can try and sort of steer your children towards things like lightsabers and Ninja Turtles. You know, but even in those genres, there are a lot of guns. You know, there's a lot. Mm-hmm. Those are very, ultimately, very shooty properties as well. So, you know, unless you just want you're just going to feed your kid Paw Patrol over and over again and never let them move on to something else. Yeah, what do you do?
It's funny how many of these properties I can think of several offhand. You know, Batman, Star Wars, whatever, have this sort of moral hierarchy of weapon selection where the most morally virtuous characters never use guns. They will use like hand-to-hand combat. They do still use weapons of various types, lightsabers and all that. But then as you go down the hierarchy, down the ladder of moral virtue into more ambiguous and then ultimately evil characters, the propensity for firearms and firearm analogs gets higher and higher.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I suppose I like that. There may be problems with it if I analyze it too much, but on the surface, I like that idea that the lightsaber is the civilized weapon and the blaster is the uncivilized weapon.
Though I guess it's complicated there because also the Sith Lords primarily use lightsabers. Yeah. So like the most evil of the most evil also eschew blasters and will only, you know, you can do a lot of damage with the lightsaber.
Yeah,
you can be a bad guy with just a laser sword.
Yeah, I have reservations at times when I am ambushed by my son with a lightsaber, because even though I'm not being, you know, shot at in the hallway, you know, he is trying to dismember me. So,
but it's dismemberment that comes from a place of love.
Yeah. And you know, I think we'll actually come back to some of that in a bit here. But let's go ahead and talk about just the topic of aggressive play, because that's, you know, very broadly what we're talking about here. Getting out of the media portion of this and getting more into like what children are doing when they're engaging with their toys and each other and their imagination. As Jeffrey Goldstein of the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands pointed out in Aggressive Toy Play, published in 1995 in The Future of Play Theory, aggressive play includes mock fighting, general roughhousing, and fantasy aggression. And we can further think of imaginary battles and war toys as being part of war play. Part, quote, aggressive toys and war toys are those that children use in play fighting and fantasy aggression, including but not limited to toys that resemble weapons. And naturally, this covers a great deal of territory. You know, an old-timey, you know, silver toy cowboy pistol. You know, there's a weapon toy. A bright orange ray gun that looks like nothing you would actually use in a real-world combat scenario. Same case. A tiny blaster in a Lego minifigure's hand. Yep, that applies. Lego blocks formed roughly into the shape of a gun. The same thing. It's a stick. Finger guns. You name it. All of that kind of falls under the same loose category here.
So basically, like most of the toys I remember having as a kid, that may be overstating it, but it is weird also that I wonder how much of this has changed generationally. I'm sure people were having this debate when we were kids, but I just remember having lots and lots of explicit weapon and even gun toys as a child and all my friends having the same stuff.
Yeah, I remember like making guns. Like I would watch like a James Bond film. Mm-hmm. And I think it was From Russia with Love, and there's the whole thing where he has like a rifle that folds up in a suitcase.
Yes.
So I somehow got my hands on an old suitcase, and I had like a pipe that I had in there.
Whoa.
And like some sort of capsule that I was pretending was the bullet, you know? It was so easy to get excited about those things.
Well, I think you should be proud of any child who shows ingenuity of that kind. Wait, did you also make yourself a Robert Shaw garrote wire?
Oh, yeah, that suitcase had so many interesting bits of spycraft in it, but I can't remember what all I had in it. It was it was the imagination was like 75% of it. So it wasn't too impressive.
Okay.
Now, generally speaking, studies have shown and continue to show that boys display more aggressive play than girls, and there are various theorized reasons here. But it doesn't mean that it's only boys by any stretch. The sex differences, though, seem to have been observed across cultures. Now, given the cultural landscape of everything, I imagine this is an area where we're going to continue to see analysis of where we are with this and where we're going with this. Because there were a number of sort of loose ends I could have gone after when I was looking at this. And originally, like, there's a whole thing about, like, gender marketing in gun weapons, particularly, mm-hmm. like, in Nerf toys. So there's a lot to consider just in this category as well. But these seem to be the trends that have played out over time, and these are the trends that are often at least brought up in any kind of study regarding aggressive play and gun play among children.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear that, aggressive play is present regardless of gender, but is more common in boys.
Yeah. Now, Goldstein pointed out that war play usually begins around age 2 and occurs once a week with at least a couple of other kids. I love this detail because I know what he's saying, but it also makes me imagine like a child keeping a schedule and you're like, hey, do you want to watch a movie this Wednesday? Like, I'm sorry, I got war play. Keith and Toby are already yeses for that, so I'm going to have to pass.
I like that, and it also makes me think of remembering back to my own childhood, how thin sometimes the boundary was between something that was explicitly war or violence play and something that was a thinly disguised or leaky surrogate for war or violence play. Some kind of game that was like almost a war that would you'd easily sort of like slip into it being a violent war. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think one of the most obvious examples is, of course, sports itself. I mean, several times a week, like what, every day you would go to PE class and, maybe you're square dancing or doing that thing with the parachute where you dance around in circles with it. But a lot of times you're playing games, sports games, and those are essentially wars. Those are wars that are carried out in a mostly nonviolent way with some rule limitations, but they kind of fulfill the same role that warfare plays. And then, on top of that, you've got all sorts of things, all sorts of games. I mean, you could, if you really wanted to stretch things, you could say a game of cards is a war. I mean, any kind of competition, right?
Yeah. But in a closer literal sense, I mean, I remember a lot of the games we came up with as a child when you're not playing like a pre-created game that has its own rules and all that external to you, but you're doing some kind of Calvin ball thing when kids do all the time, that you come up with some original game in your head and you play with your friends. A lot of those games, I recall, were basically just like half a step removed from being a cage match. It's a game that maybe involves a ball or some kind of abstract item or rules in some way, but it could easily just devolve into a battle royale.
Yeah, well, I guess a part of it is when you see kids play, a lot of it comes down to this sort of improv that they're doing. They're all bringing a certain energy and certain ideas to what they're playing and how they're playing. And so, the right combination of kids might be just concerned with building a house for a mouse or doing an archaeological dig in the dirt. Mm-hmm. But then there's going to be a kid that comes up and is going to bring the finger gun, kind of like Michael right. Scott in The Office, where in every improv scene pretends to have a gun.
Well, that scene in The Office highlights a great thing about play, actually, which is that, occasionally in an improv scene, if somebody were to bring a gun into the scene, that would be fun and interesting and it would liven things up. And, oh, what are we going to do now? But the problem comes because he introduces a gun into every improv
yes.
skit. And I think the same thing could probably be said of play. Like, it's normal for children to enact is imaginative conflict play. But when some kid wants to turn everything into an imagined violent conflict, then it's like, okay, that's not fun anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And then I don't remember if it was explicitly stated or if it was even implied, but I looking back on it, I kind of feel like it was the same gun scenario that he would bring.
Yes.
Which also ties into some of the points that are made in one of the sources we looked at for this episode. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
So anyway, the big question here is not whether kids engage in aggressive play, because they do, but it's rather about what is it for, and indeed if it actually leads to more aggressive behavior. And Goldstein points to a trio of studies from the 1990s that indicate that war games and video games with violent themes increase the frequency and duration of aggressive play, but the connection to actually aggressive behavior, that's a different story. That's ultimately a lot more complicated.
Yeah, I guess this is the big question that a lot of parents are probably worried about. Like if they watch their kid doing aggressive play, what they're worried about often is, does this mean my child is going to grow up to be a violent person?
Yeah, And we may think about this sometimes as adults when we play our video games and whatnot, especially if you're playing a game that actually gives you like a kill count, which can be a little sobering at times. And you're like, oh, my God, I sure did pretend shoot a lot of people. Am I okay? So anyway, that's a whole area we'll have to consider coming back to in the future. But I thought a good place to go from here would be to travel back to 1967 and consider something that we know as the weapons effect. So back in 67, American social psychologist Leonard Berkowitz and co-author Anthony LaPage conducted a randomized study using male college students. Now, each test involved two participants, but one of these participants was always a secret accomplice of the testers. So you only really have one random individual, one, you know, pure college student that's in here and is being tested. The other person is actually a part of the study, but pretending to be a test subject.
Right.
So the subject and the accomplice would take turns engaging in a mundane task, such as the example that I saw listed was listing ideas to help sell used cars. And first,
point a gun at the buyer.
No. The gun comes in later. But but yeah. So the actual assignment here has nothing to do with guns. It's just something mundane and and ultimately I think nonviolent. So first, the accomplice gives the subject feedback on their work. And they give this feedback with between 0 and 10 small electric shocks, okay?
Okay. 1967. Fun.
Yeah. So that's the fake test subject shocking the actual test subject. But then it's the actual test subject's turn to shock back. So this was the basic test for aggression. How many shocks would they retaliate with? How aggressive would they be? And here's where the weapon came into play. Sometimes there was a gun or guns on the table. I believe it was a shotgun and a revolver. And in other cases, they would have a badminton racket and some shuttlecocks. And there was also a control group that had no items on the table at all. The actual subjects were told that these were just part of another study and were just items to be ignored. Which, of course, sounds kind of comical in and of itself. But the big thing is it's impossible to ignore those weapons, right? I mean, it's kind of impossible to ignore anything that is there on the table, like the shuttlecocks and the badminton racket, but especially the pistol and the shotgun.
This kind of reminds me of in Mad Men, where for a long time Pete Campbell just carries a rifle around the office, and no one seems to think it's that big a deal.
Oh man, I kind of forgot about that episode, but yeah,
that comes up in several episodes. It's like a fixture.
Huh. So as you can imagine, the idea here is what happens. How does just the mere sight of weapons, the mere sight of some guns, how does that affect the individual's aggressive response? And so this is what the results were. Provoked participants who saw the guns were more aggressive than the other participants. And the authors call this the weapons effect. And they argued that it meant that the mere sight of a gun made us more aggressive. Not more aggressive without provocation, mind you, and certainly not so provoked that they say grab the gun or anything like that, but more aggressive within the boundaries of the study parameters.
Okay, so what they're claiming is to have found that when you see the gun, it's not that you pick up the gun and kill somebody with it, but when you see the gun, it's going to shape your cognition to give more shocks to this other guy and to be more vengeful.
Right. And, you know, this kind of lines up with a lot of studies that have been conducted and some that we've looked at in the past about just how random or even, not so random things in our environment, symbols, et cetera, can affect the way that we think and behave, you know, be it religious iconography or eyes staring at us from something, mm-hmm. that all of these things, all of this is stimuli that can affect the manifestation of the mind.
Oh, yeah. So if, for example, you take that study that found that people might be more generous in putting money into like a collection box if there are some eyes painted on it, or mm-hmm. Or less likely to steal money from it if there's some eyes painted on it. What's the effect if there's just a gun sitting beside it?
Yeah. Or the collection plate, yeah, has a gun. Like what if the Santa that is collecting coins with the bell, what if he also is packing heat? I don't know.
I don't know if you saw this, but actually the one of the authors here, Leonard Berkowitz, is associated with an anti-metabole that he used to communicate the results that he said he found here. And the anti-metabole was, yes, it's true that the finger pulls the trigger, but sometimes the trigger also pulls the finger.
Yes. Yeah, that's a big one. And that, of course, has been echoed a lot, because as you can well imagine, this is an argument that definitely plays into the various discussions that have taken place over the subsequent decades regarding weapons in society.
Now, I will say that one thing we know, this is basically going to be one example of a study on what's known as priming, right? The mm-hmm. priming effects of like seeing objects and how that affects cognition. And there are a lot of questions about priming studies. I mean, and some priming effects really do seem to hold up under subsequent testing. Some priming effects that people have found in studies of decades past have really been undermined by like failed replication attempts or later analyses. So part of the question would be, how does this supposed priming effect discovered in the 60s hold up under scrutiny and under review of all the subsequent research?
Yeah, exactly. Because, yeah, it's one thing for one study to observe this back in the late 60s, but how does it hold up over time and with different experiments, et cetera? So I was looking at effects of weapons on aggressive thoughts, angry feelings, hostile appraisals, and aggressive behavior, a meta-analytic review of the weapons effect literature. And this was by Benjamin et al., published in 2018 in the Personality and Social Psychology Review. In it, as the title implies, the authors looked at various later experiments into the so-called weapons effect. Because basically, there have been numerous versions of this experiment over the last 53 years. And this isn't even the first meta-analysis of them. It's just it's either the most recent or the most recent one that turned up when I was looking around. But these were the big takeaways that Benjamin et al. Put out there. First of all, weapons do appear to increase aggressive thoughts and hostile appraisals, although their effect on aggressive behavior is currently less clear. That's a direct quote from the paper. But they also say that for the relationship to become more clear, we need, quote, higher powered studies with provocation manipulation.
Ooh, provocation manipulation. The hairs on the back of my neck stand up at those two words. So what they're saying is that when you look at all of these studies over the years and you do a meta-analysis, meaning you sort of like average all the results together and look at them in total, it does seem pretty clear that seeing weapons around, the presence of weapons or weapon imagery, it makes people's thoughts more aggressive, and it increases people's tendency to perceive hostility, but there's not necessarily evidence that it makes them act more aggressive in an external way.
Right. Yeah. It's an area where, as this is often the case, more research is required.
Yeah. And I got to say, I think this is one realm where a meta-analysis is very important rather than just looking at one study here or there, because I don't have any way to prove this, but I have a pretty strong gut feeling that like gun psychology research is an area of research where there are probably some people messing around in this field with some kind of political axe to grind one way or another. And so you probably could get some individual studies that are less objective than one would hope.
Yeah. Yeah. And likewise, there's plenty of room for cherry picking from these studies as well. Like if you don't like the idea of the weapons effect, then yeah, you can definitely find some studies that fail to replicate it.
Right. And meta-analysis is helpful for multiple reasons. There was another thing that they looked into. One of the major factors tempering their findings here is a question of publication bias in the literature on the weapons effect. So I'll briefly explain. What they called the naive meta-analysis, which basically just means you average together all the results of the studies they looked at without doing any like correcting for potential biases in the results. Mm-hmm. You just take the results at face value and put them all together, look at them against one another and see what you find. And they found that this naive mean definitely confirmed that merely, quote, seeing a weapon can increase aggressive thoughts, hostile appraisals, and aggressive behavior. But they also ran a meta-analysis using techniques that are designed to detect signs of publication bias. Publication bias, of course, is not a problem just with this subject. It's a major problem affecting the quality of all kinds of scientific literature, I think especially in the social sciences. And it basically goes like this. studies that find a significant result are more likely to be published than studies that test for something and find no evidence, also known as a null result. And this is actually a problem because it leads to biases in the existing literature. If Alice does an experiment and finds some interesting hypothesis is confirmed, and then Bob does an experiment that does not yield any kind of solid conclusion, and then Alice publishes and Bob does not, this kind of keeps happening. This can give us an inaccurate picture when we try to run a meta-analysis on the existing literature. And this publication disparity could also potentially pressure researchers to probably unconsciously most of the time, lean into study designs and manipulations that would try to get a significant result showing something interesting that you can report, apart from just saying like, yeah, we looked and we didn't find anything. And this is why it's important to publish and reward well-executed studies that receive a null result. And I understand the difficulty with that. Like, I try to remember to mention them on the show when I come across them, but I admit it's a lot harder to make a good podcast talking about a bunch of studies that just didn't find anything interesting. So, you know, it's definitely something that modern science is struggling with, but it's also a good thing that researchers are aware of it, looking out for it, and trying to come up with ways of detecting the bias when it occurs. But anyway, with regards to this particular literature, what did the researchers find? How does publication bias affect the weapons effect? Well, it looks like it does not erase it, but it does appear to reduce the magnitude of it and to affect some of the conditions in which it applies. So to read from their discussion section, quote, "The naive meta-analysis showed that the weapons effect is quite robust. It occurred inside and outside the lab for many different kinds of weapons, e.g. guns, knives, spears, swords, hand grenades, for real and toy weapons, for males and females, for college students and non-students, and for people of all ages, regardless of whether they were provoked. For some distributions, the weapons effect was also robust to the influence of publication bias and/or outliers. Yet for other distributions, the weapons effect was not robust to these phenomena. The results from the sensitivity analysis," and that's the analysis they ran to look for publication bias, "showed that a publication bias had a small to moderate impact on the cognitive and appraisal outcomes. Given the difficulty in triangulating around a likely true effect size for affective and behavioral outcomes, for instance, we recommend interpreting their mean estimates with considerable caution." So as best I can tell from these results, it looks to me like the weapons effect is probably real on average with regards to cognition, how it affects what we're thinking about, but the size of the effect may be a good bit smaller than some studies have suggested. So maybe a gun on the table makes your cognition a little more violent.
Yeah. They also write that, quote, "Overall, the magnitude of the weapons effect may even be increasing over time, although that may be due to the fact that much of this research has focused on cognitive and appraisal outcomes since the 1990s.
That's a really interesting observation. So there are a couple of things here. It could be an artifact of just how the studies have evolved and their methodology mm-hmm. and things like that. But if that is real, I wonder what would explain that. If there's actually a more cognitive priming from the presence of weapons now than there were like 50 years ago, what would that mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, ultimately in the paper, they acknowledge that yes, technically the adage is true. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. But the research does indicate that guns are not neutral stimuli.
Right.
So like you say, even if it's not, even if the magnitude of the weapons effect is kind of in question, it does seem to be there. It's not neutral stimuli.
Right. And so I think this would be a counter to anybody who wants to argue like, oh, a gun is just a tool, you know, it's like, whatever. No, I mean, like if there's a gun in the room and people can see it, like their brains are going to start behaving somewhat differently.
Right. And I think on some level, I think most people realize that. Like, I mean, isn't that one of the reasons you have the gun on the wall, right? For people to see it or in the back of the truck or what have you? But again, the extent to which weapons actually influence aggressive behavior, that remains debated and in need of further study.
Right.
I mentioned already that you can find some cases where they were not able to replicate the weapons effect in studies. And then there are some other interesting cases as well. A 1991 study from Kleck and McElrath that even turned up a reverse weapons effect, which at least suggests that there's a lot more going on than an ABC sort of reaction to seeing a weapon. But it's also worth noting that it's pretty much impossible to fully conduct a real-world test of the weapons effect as it could potentially, you know, concern aggressive behavior. But it's still an essential stopping point in considering such topics as gun control, violent media, and toy guns.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think this is a very interesting and fruitful realm of research. So, yeah, more on gun psychology. Absolutely.
It certainly made me think more about how many, you know, manifestations of the gun I encounter in just an average day. You know, like all my hobbies seem to at some level or another involve the gun. Like I'm painting these little miniatures and yeah, there's like I was counting the other day while I was at my laptop. My painting stuff was on a tray next to my laptop. And I counted like I think counting both physical models and illustrations and some instructions. There were like two lightsabers and something like 15 total blaster weapons, you know. And then, like, if I'm playing a video game, there's often some sort of a blasting weapon or a gun. If I'm reading a book, there's often some sort of conflict at the heart of it. You know, it's often going to have laser guns or some weapon's going to show up at some point or another, or it's going to be swords and whatnot. And even magic wands and wizard spells are ultimately some version of the weapon.
Well, yeah, I mean, this comes back to something I was talking about at the beginning, which is that when we let our imaginations run wild, I mean, when we play, whether that's as children or adults and, you know, whatever the adult mental operations are that we call play, a lot of what we're going to be doing is imagining potential or hypothetical conflicts. And those don't have to be violent conflicts. People imagine arguments, people imagine, you know, political squabbles and all that. But almost every good story is about conflict of some kind. And one of the major types of conflict is violent, deadly conflict.
Yeah, I just to drive this home, I'm recording in a closet as usual, and I just counted 11 weapons on packaging or images or books. You know, about the only thing that's not a weapon in an illustration that as I'm looking around is a boxed game of Ticket to Ride and a VHS of Jerry Maguire, and that's it.
There are no guns in Jerry Maguire. It's
I guess I'm
it's the cinema of peace.
That's true.
Now, there was one really strange thing that I was reading in the meta-analysis you brought up a minute ago. This is yet another thing that could just be a sort of like artifact of the existing research that isn't really robust, doesn't actually mean anything, but it could be a real discovery. And if it is, it's very intriguing to me. So to read from their paper, quote, "One counterintuitive finding in our analyses concerned the comparison of real weapons and images of weapons. Specifically, the magnitude of the effect for images of weapons was larger than for real weapons. Although there is no particular theoretical reason why there should be a difference between real weapons and images of weapons, the difference was significant in the naive meta-analysis, and the difference remained significant after taking publication bias and potential outliers into consideration. Perhaps participants were more suspicious when they saw real weapons."
I mean, that seems sensible to me.
Yeah. So maybe you're saying more. So I think the idea more suspicious is that people's genuine reactions were maybe tempered in an experiment where there's a real gun on the table because they feel like something's wrong here. You know, I'm being provoked, or like, you know, they detect the priming. They start to understand what the experiment is testing for, which they shouldn't in a well-designed experiment. And that affects what they actually report in the end. That's a possibility. Another thing is just that, yeah, it emerges as some other strange artifact. But if that were a real effect, I would wonder what could explain that. I mean, would people actually be more primed to think to like perceive hostility and to think aggressive and violent thoughts when they look at a picture of a gun rather than when they see a physical gun sitting in front of them?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, the obvious answer that comes to mind that might not actually line up all that well is just, you know, it is reality. It is a thing that I can pick up, and it would become a part of my body schema, you know. And it is also something that can if used the right way or the wrong way, depending how you want to look at it, could hurt me. Whereas the picture of the gun is not going to hurt me.
So you're saying that maybe the picture What's the logic there? Are you saying maybe the picture of the gun is just like would give you more freedom to explore dangerous, aggressive thoughts because there's not actually something you need to be cautious about in your environment?
I don't know. Like I say, I don't know if this actually has any meat to it. Yeah, but certainly we can sort of bring in our own personal experience, like the difference between seeing a picture of a gun and seeing somebody say with a gun, you know. Mm-hmm. But
I guess now that I think about it, okay, so I can imagine like I watch a scene of violence in a movie and I can get pumped up about it. I'm like, yeah, time to fight. If I were to watch the same scene of violence play out in physical reality, like on the street, I would be like, oh my God, I've got to get away from here. So like maybe the physical reality of the weapon produces a different cognitive response, because like when it's just an image, you're more likely to start fantasizing about violence. And when it's a physical reality, you're more likely to respond with hesitation, caution, all that.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
All right, well, at this point, let's get back into the discussion of aggressive play versus aggressive behavior with children. A really great source that I enjoyed reading for this is an article that popped up on Slate in 2015 from Melinda Winter Moyer, a science journalist, science author, who I feel like you've definitely encountered her work before. She's been published in a number of different major publications. She's written some books on parenting. And this particular article was titled, "It's Fine for Kids to Play with Pretend Guns," which I suppose that kind of gives away the overall answers that she presents in the article. Mm-hmm. But it's a great article, and it touches on some of the key gun safety principles in modern parenting, you know, such as not only properly storing guns and ammo separately in a household, but also inquiring about gun safety at any house that your child might be going over to, and how you know, parents have been pushing to just sort of make this a regular and not weird part of our discourse, or, you know, as not weird as it can be. You know, it's just something you ask, something you inquire about. And, you know, this added with the reality that gun safety education is only so effective in preventing children from handling or playing with real firearms if given the opportunity, which is interesting to note because, again, coming back to how we think about our own lives versus the statistics, it's easy to think, well, my child knows the difference between a real gun and a fake gun, or my child, I've gone over some of the safety tips. You know, maybe I've even enrolled the child in some sort of class. They're going to know how to be safe with a gun. But it doesn't look like the research actually lines up with this. And there have been some very recent studies on this to back it up. A 2020 study from Rutgers University found that gun safety programs do not prevent children from handling firearms. And then there was also a presentation at the American Academy of Pediatrics, their 2018 national conference and exhibition, that found that most children surveyed couldn't tell real guns from toy guns.
Yeah, I was reading about that one, actually. That's a...
And here's a question that came up in 2017. Are children who see movie characters using guns more likely to use them? Well, this particular study published in JAMA Pediatrics found that children who watched a PG-rated movie clip containing guns played with a disabled real gun longer and pulled the trigger more often than children who saw the same movie not containing guns.
Okay, not super surprising. Kids love to act out scenes from movies that they've liked.
Yeah, I bring this up just I think it's all good information to have in your head regarding your expectations of even your own perfect child, you know?
Right.
This is just kids statistically based on these studies. Now, Moyer goes on from all this, though, points out that, you know, first of all, aggression play is, of course, normal and especially noted among boys and in boys and among boys, you know, in individual boys, but then also when boys play together. In a 2013 study from Fair and Russ, Early Education and Development is the publication, the researchers found that preschoolers who engage in oral aggression play, such as having one stuffed animal bite the hell out of another stuffed animal, these children were less aggressive in the classroom. And the speculation here is the more violence that kids incorporate into their pretend play, the more they may learn to control violent impulses in real life and control their own emotions. And you've seen even sort of stronger emphasis on all this. A 2013 paper by Hart and Tannock, published in Children Australia, even speculated that we may be interfering with a child's social, emotional, physical, cognitive, and communicative development if we try to prevent them from play fighting and engaging in this kind of like creative play aggression. Now, there's some caveats here that Moyer points out. First of all, if a child is actually hurting other kids during play fighting, then there may be some impulse control issues there. It might be something that requires further attention. Mm-hmm. It also might be of concern if there is no imagination involved in the process. If it is, as Moyer puts it, a case of a child simply hitting one toy with the other over and over again. So narrative ultimately seems to be an important part of all of this.
Also makes sense.
Yeah. So the creation of violent or war narratives seems to be key, Moyer says, because mere imitation, or say recreating a key battle scene from Star Wars, is not engaging in the sort of play that actually works out problems. And I have to say, I found this pretty interesting, you know, from a personal standpoint, but also just looking at toys, because there are a lot of toys and playsets out there that sell themselves on providing you with the tools to just recreate pivotal scenes in a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. It's certainly the case with, say, Star Wars and Lego, for example. You know, you'll find sets that are all about like key duels, key action scenes, but it may not be that rote reproduction of key scenes that's important, but the creation of different narratives.
Well, I got to say, and unfortunately, this is just anecdotal again, but, you know, in my memory of childhood, there was a ton of recreating with toys and just out of pure imagination play, in both cases, just recreating scenes directly from movies. But also, a lot of times, I feel like that type of play would evolve. So you would mm-hmm. start by recreating a scene in a movie with Legos or with toys, and then it would turn into what happens next. And then from there, you just sort of branch out.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely see this in my own son. Like, I remember him building this, putting up a battle scene with Legos, and he was like, "Dad, this is the second battle of Geonosis." And I was like, "All right." And but then it did evolve from there to where now it's a different battle scene every time I go into his room. And there are often these little side things he set up where it's like clone troopers camping and looking after an animal or some other, like it's kind of an interesting puzzle to try and put together the narratives that he's clearly playing out in all of these little scenes.
Are they ever looking over a Baby Yoda?
We don't have a Baby Yoda yet. So okay. maybe by the time Christmas rolls around, there'll be a little Baby Yoda for them to interact with.
What do you think the next Star Wars baby is going to be? So we've had Baby Yoda. I'm thinking about Baby Darth Maul. Can you get a Baby Darth Maul?
Well, yeah, you could definitely have a baby of his species. I mean, on the Clone Wars series, you had a baby Hutt. You had a Huttlet, and that
what?
Was pretty cute.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I guess I got to watch this.
Yeah.
I've said that a bunch of times on the show now.
My son informs me that in some Star Wars Lego show, there's a baby Wampa that's super adorable as well. So, I mean, really, you make a baby out of anything in the Star Wars universe, it's going to be adorable.
But you get that Wampa. It's cute when it's a baby. It starts to grow up. You can't just flush it down the toilet like an alligator. Don't do that to alligators, by the way. Don't buy baby alligators. But
yeah, or baby Wampas.
Right.
Now, this isn't to say that parents can't or shouldn't enter into this sort of thing, that they shouldn't interrupt, or maybe not interrupt, but at least converse with their child about these sort of holy experiments and conflict play. And Moyer cites Diane Levin, an early education specialist at Wheelock College in Boston, and the author of The War Play Dilemma. Levin says that you can ask follow-up questions to statements about, say, killing bad guys, with questions like, well, what did the bad guy do? Is there anything else that can be done besides killing the bad guy? There are conversations you can have about conflict and the nature of conflict and how this imagined conflict lines up with real life. Plus, they point out that trying to prevent things like gunplay are likely to backfire anyway, making it more desirable. So it's best to engage in conversations about it. Like, it's better to have conflict play is allowed, but it's something we can have conversations about so that we can, you can have these important conversations about how real conflict works and the ramifications of violence in the real world.
Yeah. You don't want to just send the gunplay underground.
Yeah. Now, I think it's also worth noting that some of this would seem to go far beyond anything specifically involving guns and weapons. For instance, a June 2020 study from the University of Cambridge found that children whose fathers make time to play with them from a very early age may find it easier to control their behavior and emotions as they grow up. And the key distinction here, and I think one worth pointing out for single parents and same-sex parents, is that it's not about the gender of the father, et cetera. It's about a more physical play style and stuff like, quote, tickling, chasing, and piggyback rides. But this study in question looked at 40 years of research and found, quote, a consistent correlation between father-child play and children's subsequent ability to control their feelings.
So play more in the domain of roughhousing. Maybe sometimes helps children understand boundaries better and control their outbursts and impulses.
Yeah. So like, this is me, not the study, but I instantly think of the times when I've been kind of playing rough with the kiddo and I get kind of clocked, you know, or something ends up really hurting. Like maybe that kind of thing is a part of understanding, like, you know, restraint and the boundaries of physical aggression, et cetera.
You find out what too rough is by like going there with a responsible adult present.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out there. You know, hopefully this gave everybody a little, you know, food for thought. And we would love to hear from everybody out there if you have any thoughts on what we discussed here today, you know, especially in and around the holidays when inevitably there are going to be toy weapons under the tree. They might be human size. They might be very miniature. They might be for grown-ups. They might be for kids. But, you know, what are we supposed to do with that? How are we supposed to think about these things? So I thought it was a good episode to roll out this time of year.
Oh, man, we didn't even get into toy weapons for adults, such as, like, what do you call it when, like, an adult person buys a sword? They're not planning on using it in battle. They just wanted to have it.
Yeah, that you want to put it on the wall.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you know, if you think about the weapons effect, yeah, that means every time I walk into the living room, I'm going to be touched by the weapons effect, right? It's interesting. I mean, then also, if you buy that sword to put on the wall, you are going to hold it at some point.
You might film yourself on your phone doing tricks with it.
Yeah, it's going to happen. If you have a rental house and you put on like Airbnb or something and you have a sword on the wall, people who stay there are going to try and take the sword off the wall. They're going to go for it. Even if it's fixed in place, it's going to be like the sword in the stone.
Bolt that sucker down.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go and close it out then. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Wherever that happens to be, we just hope that you rate, review, and subscribe. Episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind come out on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We have some other shorter content that comes out on Mondays and Wednesdays, Fridays. That's going to be Weird House Cinema. And then what on Saturday? You get a repeat episode. So it's a full menu of possibilities.
Your audio stockings are stuffed. Anyway, huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Minnie Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.